ABC News Radio, I'm Mike Vaccara at the White House. Officials say the smoke from a massive New Mexico wildfire has spread across the state, prompting health alerts over a wide area, including Albuquerque.
We couldn't really go outside yesterday. It was really thick.
It looks pretty bad, and it looks like it could harm a lot of people.
There's still zero containment on the 100,000-acre blaze. Subtropical storm Beryl has begun moving faster towards the southeast U.S. coast and is expected to make landfall tonight. The National Hurricane Center is predicting it's not going to become a hurricane.
It's running out of time to strengthen. It has a little bit of warm water to go over here that could allow it to at least maintain its strength, those warm waters of the Gulf Stream, but I don't expect any significant strength.
That's Rick Knapp of the Hurricane Center speaking to the Weather Channel. Beryl's winds are holding at 50 miles per hour. Afghan authorities say an airstrike by the U.S.-led NATO coalition has killed 8 members of a family in eastern Afghanistan. 6 of those killed were children. This is NBC News Radio. 2 American men are facing charges in Tokyo in connection with the strangling death of an Irish exchange student. Tokyo police arrested the 2 Saturday following the death of Nicola Furlong. She was discovered dead in a hotel room. It's the unofficial start of summer and for many a 3-day weekend. Some are choosing to honor veterans and those who died while serving in the military. This man visited the Navy Memorial in Washington, D.C.
It's very patriotic. It makes you feel that you're to be proud to be an American and we've still got a heartbeat left in us yet.
President Obama will spend Memorial Day at Arlington National Cemetery and the Vietnam War Memorial. Today's Indianapolis 500 is seen as wide open as there are no clear favorites. It's also expected to be a hot one, with temperatures climbing to 90 degrees. The excessive heat could translate to IndyCars laying down plenty of rubber on the track, making conditions slippery. Track conditions have not been this hot since 1978. More news at MSNBC.com. I'm Mike Vaccara, NBC News Radio.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brings me to a shopping mall. Of course, when it comes to shopping for car insurance, most people go to GEICO. I mean, with all the discounts they offer, why would you shop anywhere else? There are discounts for complete and defensive driving courses, multi-policy discounts, and discounts for being accident-free. You know, this mall is a real maze. I think I passed that candle store about 5 times.
For a free rate quote, visit GEICO.com to see how much you could save. GEICO, 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Do you hate commercials? Even this one? Even if we talk in a really soothing voice? Well, what about a commercial about Dish's Hopper, which is an HD DVR that lets you skip commercials automatically, so you can watch your show straight through without interruption? You'd like that commercial, right? Still no? How about if this commercial suddenly ended?
Watch commercial-free TV with the Hopper, the new whole home HD DVR from Dish. Call 1-800-WATCH-TV to get Dish today. Only available for playback of select HD primetime shows and must be enabled by customer. Programming sold separately.
And now, on the home front, sponsored by your local Jeep dealers.
If you have a military spouse far away, you know how daunting it is to know they'll be gone for weeks, months, even upwards of a year or more. Setting goals can help pass the time. Try setting goals for things that need to be done tomorrow, next week, next month. Tackle various projects around the house. Set exercise goals. That can be a fun and healthy project for the whole family. Getting children involved is key. Challenge them to read a certain number of books within a month or by the time mom or dad gets home. And if you have goals, well, you have to have rewards, right? Find a way to reward yourself and your kids in small ways when they achieve their goals. They can gain a sense of satisfaction in completing the tasks and at the same time be a little closer to seeing their faraway service member again.
Make tracks to your local Jeep vehicle dealer today and take advantage of an exciting military cash allowance on the full line of legendary Jeep vehicles. And Jeep wants to express its extreme gratitude and pride for your military service.
You know, choosing how you listen to radio is important. If you don't visit HDRadio.com, you won't learn about the new local HD2, HD3 radio stations. If you don't hear the new local HD2, HD3 stations, you won't hear everything you should. If you don't hear everything you should, you won't understand what your friends are talking about. To understand what your friends are talking about, visit HDRadio.com to learn about HD radio receivers like the Pioneer DEH44 HD. Now only $120 at Walmart.
Welcome to today's lottery drawing. And today's winning numbers are not yours, not yours, and another number that's not yours. And the final number is not yours.
When it comes to having money, don't rely on luck. Brew your own coffee at home instead of buying that latte. Brown bag it to work instead of ordering in. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas on how to save.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. I'm joined by my co-host, Ed Alera, of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. And we have a great pair of guests next, Andy Harper and Amanda Harper. And yes, they are related. Andy's the CEO. Amanda is the president of a company called GaleTech. So welcome to both of you. And would one of you tell us, what is GaleTech?
So GaleTech's an organization, a small company that looks after the IT, the technology solutions for small to medium-sized businesses. Our whole aim in life is to enable small businesses to leverage their IT to the best of their capabilities.
Can you give us an example of maybe something that small business struggles with that you just, you know, fix or make go away?
Well, one of the areas that we really focus on is mobility. And that, you know, putting into place solutions that allow business owners and their staff to work from any place at any time on any type of device. If you're a small business owner, you're probably wearing multiple hats, juggling the demands of your work with what's going on in your personal life, and knowing that you can pull out a device from wherever you are and check on the status of your business is a real advantage.
Would you tell us how big or small, by whatever measure you want to use, is GaleTech?
GaleTech is a small company. We have a staff of four. We are growing, though, as we speak. We are located in Old Town Manassas, and the majority of our clients are located in the Washington, D.C. metro area. However, we do have clients throughout the United States and overseas as well.
So if you only have a staff of four, but you have national client base, there must mm-hmm. be some sort of working smart efficiencies that you guys are really good at.
So one of the big things that we've done, and we realized early on, was that to do our business properly, we had to invest heavily in the technology that allows us to support our clients in the most effective way. So we use some very advanced equipment, and we monitor client networks from remote, and we can get in, we can support them, we can remediate problems behind the scenes because of the investment that we've made.
And also, we're a good case study in how you can use technology to work efficiently and effectively while maintaining a smaller footprint, if that is what you want to do.
Perfect. When did you found the company?
So we founded GaleTech in 2004.
Yeah. And I'm going to take a wild guess here. One of you is from Scotland and the other is not. Is that correct?
That could be correct, yes.
Okay. Yes. How did you meet? Amanda, you're from West Virginia. We're going to get more into that later. Andy, you're from Scotland. But how did you meet?
Oh, this is a great story, and Andrew does not like the way that I tell it. So I'm going to defer to Andrew.
So we actually met at the post-launch party for the launch of a Trident test missile from a British Royal Navy submarine.
Not exactly Match.com.
No, it wasn't Match.com. No. It was the most unexpected place to meet someone you'd ever imagine.
Well, to walk us through what happened, please.
So my job, I was head of technical liaison at that point for the Trident submarine project. And I was at Cape Canaveral, Florida. We were doing a test launch for Trident missiles, a highly complex operation. And one of my roles was managing certain parts of that operation. And we'd just done the test launch, and I'd been away from my office in D.C. for 6 weeks. My job back there was to know everyone and everything that was going on in the program as much as possible so that the British interests could be looked after. And the person sitting to my right...
Your wife.
Who's now my wife. say to me, you know, oh yes, I work there too, and my instant response was, you can't. I know everyone who's there.
Yeah, I was down there at the Cape. I was overseeing the VIP visitors who were there for tours to watch the launch, and so, you know, I wasn't interacting with the Brits. I was, you know, more familiar with the Americans who were there.
Right.
And so when we met at the Officers Club after the launch, it was very surprising to have not met before because we worked for the same organization in Washington. Our offices were on the same hall. And we had never seen each other in D.C.
Wow. So it took a missile for the two of you to meet.
Yes, it did.
Okay. Tell us about growing up in Scotland, please, Andy.
So I grew up in East Kilbride, just south of Glasgow in Scotland. It was a new town built after the Second World War. The whole concept was to bring nice living environments, good working environments to lower class people moving out of the cities like Glasgow.
So that was your family, lower class economically?
Yeah, I would define ourselves as a lower class family from an economical perspective.
And did it provide that opportunity for you?
It didn't. I'd always had a love of engineering. It was something that was really fascinating to me. You know, the concept of being able to make something do something that you'd never expected it possible. It was always fascinating. I then discovered that I could join the Royal Navy as an officer, and they would pay for me to get my degree, they'd pay for my degree, and I'd get a salary all at the same time, and that just sounded like, you know, nirvana to me.
Yeah, in fact, in the green room, you described it, quote, as riches to me.
Absolutely, riches to me, because really to see an education, an income from that education to that extent was really quite a shock.
So your father must have been jumping up and down with pride, saying, "That's my boy."
Well, he was and he wasn't. He was like absolutely delighted at the fact that I really wanted to do this, but convinced that it wouldn't be possible to make that leap across the classes because an officer in the forces was never really considered a lower class position.
You raise a good point that we in America take for granted, that the goal is to move up,
yes,
and you're rewarded and applauded for it. But I take it that wasn't the standard that you grow up with.
Well, it wasn't really. Like, my dad always wanted me to do better, but he was never convinced that you could. I think it was really the way to look at it. And so I actually spent my first years in the Navy getting my degree, just going from hurdle to hurdle to hurdle, thinking, I just want to get past the next point. I just want to get past the next point. And it wasn't until I'd been in the Navy for some 6 years, I thought, you know what, I can do this, and I am doing this. And then I started building it as a career.
Did your father's words drive you, or did they discourage you, or did they make you hungry? What did your father's words do to you?
So it made me hungry to do better, but it also made me concerned that I might not do it, that I might not achieve the dream. So I didn't want to dream too much because I didn't want to disappoint myself more than anything.
Wow. Tell us about growing up in West Virginia, Amanda.
You're right, I did. I grew up in West Virginia. My father was a family physician, and my mom was a nurse by training, but she owned a photography business for most of my youth. So I grew up with two business owners in the family, and that was a very interesting experience. I took it for granted and never actually gave it any thought. But one would think that growing up in West Virginia that I would be an outdoor person, and that is something that my parents would have instilled and fostered in me. But despite their best efforts, I was not a happy child in West Virginia for the most part.
So you were an indoor girl,
I was very much an indoor girl. I was in love with books, and in fact, most of my punishments growing up involved being forced to either watch TV or being forced to go outside.
Is that a big deal, or it's just, you know, so what? It's just part of life. You know, I don't like to go outside. Or is there something deeper there?
Oh, for me, it was a big deal. I didn't like the outside and too many things. Like, for example, gardening. The fear of not knowing what I was going to find when I pulled up that scoop of dirt. Was there going to be worms? Were there going to be bugs? And it wasn't the insects themselves. It was just the not knowing. I'm very much the type of person who likes to have an idea of what's coming. I'm a planner by nature, and I couldn't control the circumstances.
So you meet this gentleman, Andy, over a missile, and in your words in the green room, quote unquote, you realize you had been missing out on things in life.
Absolutely.
What do you mean?
I was a very introverted person. I was not a big risk taker. And so when I met Angel, you know, he pushed me to try a lot of new things and to take risks. For example, we joke, and Andrew, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think when we met, I ate 6 or 7 foods total. And, you know, I had been a vegetarian / vegan for, you know, 20 years at that point. And it wasn't for moral or ethical reasons. It was because I had such a limited palate.
And the first meal I cooked for her was grilled chicken stuffed with garlic wrapped in prosciutto.
With a side of rice. And I didn't eat rice either.
But did you eat it that night?
Absolutely not. I cut it up and I pushed it around.
So how did you go from that? You only eat six or seven foods and you're afraid to go outside to bungee jumping off of which falls?
Last summer, I took a trip overseas with my mom, and we went to Zimbabwe, Zambia, and South Africa, and I had the opportunity to bungee jump off of the Victoria Falls Bridge.
And nobody made you do it?
Andy
didn't stand out there pushing you off?
No one made me do it. In fact, my mother said, I don't want you to do it. I can't even watch. And so she didn't watch at first. But, you know, we have a five-year-old daughter, and I see in her the traits that I used to have in myself, sort of shy, afraid to take chances, afraid to act because of not knowing what was going to happen. And I thought, you know what, I'm not doing her a service. I'm not setting a good example for her. And so I decided I was going to bungee jump, not once, but twice. And I was going to pay a camera crew to record this. So when my daughter would get scared and would be afraid to try something new, I could say to her, watch me jump. You know how scared I am of this, and yet I was able to do it. Don't you think it's worth you giving it a shot?
So you've overcome tremendous fears. You've overcome a little bit less than conviction in your father that you could make it. And you've got a successful company now. Are these related in any way?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I would say they're absolutely related. But one of the key things is that realizing that you can do, that as long as you put your mind to it, you can achieve things that are way beyond what you think you actually can.
And it's like when Andrew came to me with this idea of, you know, hey, I have this idea, you know, small business clients are not being served, you know, they're not giving the support that I think they need, and I think that they can get better and that I'm the person to provide that. Why don't we start a business? My first response was, are you crazy? I don't know how to run a business. We don't know what we're doing. We can't start a company.
But that was 8 years ago, and you guys are growing stronger and better than ever.
Yeah, we are. I mean, we've come a long way. Andrew was nominated this year for what's called the SMB 150, which is a list of the 150 most influential IT decision makers globally. And, yeah, we've come a long way.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I feel like we've just scratched the surface. We're almost out of time, so we'd love to have you back. Would you give us the web address for Gale Tech, please?
Yeah, absolutely. Our web address is www.galetech.com, and that's spelled GALETEK.com.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Andy Harper, who is the CEO, and his wife, Amanda Harper, who is the president of Gale Tech. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ed Alera, of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders like Andy and Amanda. And Ed and I will be back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is
Rick Palmer.
Rick, who are you with?
I'm the Vice President of Business Development with Integrity Management Consulting.
What is Integrity Management Consulting?
Integrity is a rapidly growing small business here in McLean. And we're proud to be ranked as one of the top growing, fastest growing companies in the local area and in the state of Virginia.
What kind of work do you do? In just a few words.
We do acquisition planning and program management support.
For the federal government?
For the federal government.
Okay. Now, you're not here really to talk too much about what Integrity does. You're here to do some celebrating. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely.
What are you celebrating?
Well, we've just been named one of Virginia's Fantastic 50 Companies for 2012. We're one of the fastest-growing companies in the state of Virginia, and we're going to be receiving that award very shortly.
Tonight?
Yes.
Fantastic. You're also one of the seven precious jewels?
Yes, we were just named one of Consulting Magazine's seven small jewels for 2012 as one of the fastest-growing companies in the area.
But we're not done yet, are we?
No, absolutely not.
There was one more thing you were going to celebrate.
We have a good nationwide presence, and particularly in the southwestern United States. We just opened a field office in Fort Worth, Texas, where a lot of our business is.
You're able to accomplish all these things because you're able to focus and compete effectively in a full and open environment. How are you able to do that, in a few words?
Well, how we're able to do that is just the fact that we evolved our company very, very quickly. The founders and the owners did that, and quite honestly, we just did not attempt to do all things all at the same time. Focused on some great areas and built the business where we could.
We've been speaking with Rick Palmer of Integrity Management Consulting, and that was your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. I'm joined by my co-host, Ed Alera, of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney. And we are thrilled to introduce to you our next guest. His name is Jack Walton. Jack is the executive director of American Youth Philharmonic Orchestras. So welcome to the show, Jack, and tell us, what is American Youth Philharmonic Orchestras?
American Youth Philharmonic Orchestras, as we call it, AYPO, is one of the premier orchestras in the United States. Youth come to this program, audition to learn more about professional music. Some of our students want to pursue music careers, so this is a training opportunity for those young people to experience that.
Youth means what?
Our youngest students generally are about fourth grade. We have four orchestras, and you can play in this orchestra until age 21.
Okay. How big or small, by whatever measure you want to use?
American Youth Philharmonic is a small not-for-profit. We have three full-time staff, a part-time person, with contract artistic staff, et cetera. We're around 45, 50 people.
And AYPO has been around since when?
We were formed in 1964.
Okay. If you could relate to us, as you did in the green room, the difference between going to one of these concerts and perhaps what many parents are accustomed to when they go listen to their children perform.
Our continuing challenge is that perception of youth orchestras in most adults' mind is their remembrance of what happened in fifth and sixth grade, and the squawky intonation, obvious love for the music that their children showed. But when you speak to an adult now and say, you really need to come hear these performances by these young people in AYPO, they look at you and go, I think I'm going to go get my root canal done that day. And it's a perception that is unfortunate, because these young people play at a near professional level at our top orchestra.
So are these all child prodigies, and that's why they're so good?
Not in the least. These are young people who love their music. They maybe were pushed a bit by parents at some point once a talent was discovered. But they are not necessarily child prodigies. They work very hard, which are some wonderful lessons that the kids learn by participating in such a program. They win competitions all over the country. In addition to the four orchestras, we have chamber ensembles that require different kinds of learning as well.
Well, there's sort of a Harold Hill Music Man issue here. Are you the business side or the music side?
Personally, I am the business side of this organization. However, my training and background is the music side, and that's my true love for making music.
You've been the executive director for how long?
Right at 2 years now.
Okay, but you were once a high school music teacher, is
that
correct?
That's correct.
What happened?
I loved my life as a music teacher, and I got to a point in my life around 12 years into my career as a high school music teacher that I realized I'd been working very, very hard to make 12 grand a year, and I had aspirations for myself and my family that even back then those were not the best of dollars. So I realized that if I was going to achieve some of the things I wanted for myself and my family, I was going to have to look at some options.
So pretty simple decision, huh?
No. It was a very difficult decision, because I was put on earth to make music. That's what I do. It's what I do well. And it was a difficult decision to come to where I had to realize, for me to achieve some of the things I wanted to achieve personally, professionally, I was going to have to leave my chosen profession, and it was now going to have to be an avocation.
So tell us about decision day and putting on the headphones.
Yeah, it was I came home one night after I had made this decision to resign from my position at the high school. I was on my way to going to graduate school to get my get my doctorate degree, and I realized that even then that was not going to make the kind of difference I wanted. So I had to make the decision to leave teaching. So I came home that night after I kind of internalized that decision, came home, put on my headphones. I remember them so well, those big old Koss headphones.
Pro 4AAs.
Absolutely, you got it. And put on the Brahms Liebeslieder waltzes with the Robert Shaw Chorale, and I cried for 45 minutes.
So what business position did you take?
Of a closely related business, precious metals, commodity trading. Is that close to school teaching? I had a friend who had left his business to go into the metals industry in that time period, and it was kind of an amazing awakening to me that I could make this kind of money doing something that I was interested in the first place. And I was in 1973-74, I was making six figures as a commodity broker, and I thought I'd died and gone to heaven.
That's a pretty intense business.
Yes, so, it is.
I mean, split-second decisions constantly. And then you ran into the sort of the cornering the silver market scam.
Yeah, I was in that. I was in the market at that during those times.
Yes.
It was fascinating. I guess what was the most amazing thing to me about that transition into a totally different business was because I was going from a school teacher to a strictly sales job, pure sales. And I'm going, I don't know how to sell. And then I realized I'd been selling classical music to high school kids for 12 years, and they bought it. So I was going to be able to sell all right.
Take us back in time to Texas, growing up, only child until 9 years old.
Mm-hmm. It was a great childhood. I'm the son of a Baptist minister, and I still came out okay. It was a great life because my family was very close, although it was a small family. We sang together. We went to church together. We had many, many friends.
Danced together?
No, I was a Baptist minister's child, remember? But yes, I danced. I found out that the Methodist youth ministry had, after church on Sunday nights, they would meet in the basement of the Methodist church in the town, and they would have dances. And so I would go visit the youth ministry of the Methodist church. Mom and Dad were happy about that because they didn't know about the dancing part, but I loved it. Yeah. I had a grand time.
I guess your mom was also happy about some of your exploits in the balcony at church on Sunday.
Oh, you remembered to ask that. I, like any other teenager in high school, you tend to sit in the back couple of rows in the balcony at church, and we were cutting up a little bit, talking one Sunday morning and not really paying close attention. And I suddenly saw my mother, who was singing in the choir, stand up from her chair in her robe, walk down the center aisle of the church, up into the balcony, and sit right between me and the young lady that I was talking to. Needless to say, I didn't do that anymore. It was a great, impressive moment in my time.
So how did you get from a commodities trader in Texas to a youth orchestra businessman in Northern Virginia?
Somewhat circuitously. I in Dallas, I sang in the Dallas Symphony Chorus, and was special performance conductor of the Dallas Symphony Chorus when we do run-out concerts. And one Sunday, final concert in the new concert hall in Dallas that was built there in like 1988-89, the executive director saw me coming out of the hall in the lobby, and I reached out to say, oh my gosh, what a wonderful concert season this has been. And I never got it out of my mouth because he said, Jack, what are you doing these days? And I said, what do you mean, what am I doing? Where are you working? And I said, I'm in a financial services firm here in Dallas, and I'm somewhat quietly looking because that was a time in Dallas when economics were not too great. And he said, call me tomorrow. There's an opportunity opening up in the Dallas Symphony that I think you'd be perfectly suited for. And I said, sure. And he turned around and walked off before I could even ask him.
So was the point, the phase in your life where you were doing the commodities trading, mm-hmm. and you were doing the financial services, is that like a black hole in your life?
Oh, absolutely not.
Or was it part of the journey that needed to be taken?
Yes. In many, many ways, that I didn't take any business courses in college. I was a music major. I had my coursework pretty full, and so I had no formal business courses and training other than just some basics. And as it turned out, my sojourn took me through some business actual hands-on experience that I had to learn. I ultimately started as a sales broker and ultimately became regional manager of a large brokerage office in Texas. So I was successful. I had to figure out how some of these things worked, and those skills have transferred to my current career.
When you were a high school music teacher on decision day deciding to leave teaching, did you ever think you'd get back to this point?
Never. Never. I never thought I'd come back to this.
How does it feel to be back now?
I've come full circle because I'm once again working with young people who care deeply about music, who want to excel, who take instruction, who understand that if their conductor raises the bar of expectations for their performance level, they take it as, we should be doing that, and they do their best to become as good in their performance and their technical aspect of their instruments as possible. And if you hear one of our orchestra concerts, you'll go away and the first thing you say was, wow, I had no idea young people could play at a near professional level.
Would you give us the web address for American Youth Philharmonic Orchestra?
Absolutely. It's www.aypo.org.
One more time. Don't want anybody to miss it.
www.aypo.org.
Fantastic. Thank you, Jack. We've been speaking with Jack Walton. Jack is the executive director of the American Youth Philharmonic Orchestras. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ed Alera, of the law firm Buchanan Ingersoll Rooney, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders just like Jack. And Ed and I will be right back in just a moment after this important business spotlight. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your business spotlight. Today's guest is
Mike Harden.
Mike, who are you with?
I'm with Vistage International.
What is Vistage?
Vistage is by far the largest and probably the most prestigious organization of CEOs in the world. We have about 15,000 members in 16 different countries.
And what does Vistage do?
Vistage is there specifically to help people get better at what they do at the CEO level. Our goal is to help CEOs become better decision makers, to grow their businesses, to do more with what they've got.
And what do you do at Vistage?
Well, I'm a chair with Vistage, and a chair simply means that I chair a local group of chief executive officers, and I coach each of those people individually and try to make myself available to help them with their business needs.
Why is coaching so important to a CEO? Don't they have it all figured out?
I wish they did. I'd been a CEO myself for a long time, and I wish I'd had a coach. There's just too much going on in today's world. You're being pulled in all kinds of different directions. You're making decisions every day, and it's just so isolated for some people to have to make those decisions without the ability to go to other people.
There's a plethora of coaches out there. Why are you a fantastic CEO coach? Why you?
Well, I would say that what I do is I help good CEOs become great CEOs, and what I do with that is I have certain axioms of business that I try to stress, and one of the first ones is that you deserve the people that you hire and keep.
What does that mean?
Well, you know, if you have A players on your staff, they're going to do a great job for you, and you deserve to have them. If you have B players, well, then you deserve to have B players.
So you're looking for what type of person?
I look for CEOs who are lifelong learners who want to be better at what they do and need someone like me to help them get there.
How do we find you, Mike?
Well, I have a blog, and most CEOs look at it. It's called CEOSuccessCoach.com.
We've been speaking with Mike Harden of Vistage and CEOSuccessCoach.com. This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your business spotlight. You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions. And I'm joined by my co-host, Ed Alera, of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney. And we have a fantastic lineup of guests for you today, including Peter Hardcastle, principal of the Consulting and Actuary Division and CFO of Chiron, Andy Harper and Amanda Harper, CEO and president, respectively, of Gale Tech, Tom Loftus, CEO of LS Technologies, and Jack Walton, Executive Director of the American Youth Philharmonic Orchestras. So let's get started introducing you to our first guest today. His name is Peter Hardcastle. He is the Principal Consulting Actuary and the CFO of a company called Chiron. So welcome to the show, Peter, and tell us, what is Chiron?
Hello. Chiron is a full-service actuarial consulting firm specializing in U.S. benefit plans.
Now, on the back of your business card, it said something about training and mentoring heroes. Is that what your company does, or are you actuaries?
We're actuaries, but we like to think of our clients as heroes, and we mentor them and educate them as to how their benefit plans work.
So tell us about the name Chiron. What does that mean?
Chiron was a mythological centaur. He was he was educated by Apollo and Artemis, and ultimately advanced his shared his knowledge with others. He gave up his immortality and became known as the star sign Sagittarius.
And so this is the mythological figure after which your company is named.
Yes, yes.
Got it. And so you are heroic actuaries. What does an actuary do? If you can give us a simple example of that.
Yeah, we specialize in the measurement of risk and financial management of risk. In particular, we look after pensions, and we recommend contribution rates for defined benefit pension plans, and also health and welfare plans.
If you're not doing that important work, what happens to the average person, let's say?
Well, essentially, the average person that's in a defined benefit pension plan, for example, wants to know that the money is being invested in the plan and that sufficient money is being contributed by the plan sponsor in order that the benefit will be paid out when the person ultimately retires. And it's the actuary's job to do that.
Thank you for doing that important work. That is very important work.
How did you get into this intellectually demanding business?
Well, it all goes back to when I was round about 17, and I was at school doing a course called Double Mathematics, which meant that I was going to do two exams, one in mathematics and another one in advanced mathematics. Not a very popular course.
Before we go any further, did you volunteer for Double Mathematics, or were you forced into it?
I actually volunteered. indeed, when I was just deciding on what courses to do, I wanted to become a lawyer, and I wanted to read economics and history and mathematics, and I couldn't because economics was set against mathematics and history. So I could have done any two of the three, but not the three. So I basically said, well, I really want to do the mathematics, so I'm going to do double mathematics and physics.
So you volunteered for it. So you're 16, 17 years old in the double mathematics class.
Yeah.
Take it away.
And, well, a guy came down from Liverpool from an insurance company there and talked to the seven boys of the mathematics, double mathematics set, about life as an actuary. And he basically said that he got to work with numbers, which was good if you are interested in mathematics, and that the pay was pretty good too. So I thought, I'm going to be sitting behind a desk when I finally join the real world. I may as well do something that involves numbers and pays well.
So at 16 or 17, you made a life decision that you have not changed.
Yes, that's correct. I set out to be an actuary, much to the amazement of my parents, who'd never even heard of the word actuary, let alone knew what one did. And, I set out.
From that day forward, have you always been 100% sure this is what I want and have been meant to do?
There are some days when you always question, but probably 95% of the time, yes. I'm very happy with the career choice.
Mathematicians tend to be introverted, but you're quite voluble, and you started a company, which is a different skill set. How did that come about?
Well, I think that there are sort of two types of actuary out there. There are consulting actuaries, which is where I ended up, and there are the actuaries that work in the insurance company crunching numbers for your, you know, things like your insurance premiums, car payment premiums, you know, all of the insurance products. And indeed, when I left university and looked for jobs, I interviewed with five actuarial employers, and four of them were insurance companies, and one of them was a consulting firm. And the difference in the people between who I met in the consulting environment compared with the type of actuaries that I was talking to in the insurance company environment, it just seemed to fit. I wanted to be a consultant.
This is a very specialized mathematics occupation. How did you know, when did you know you had the gift for this?
I think that it wasn't really until I started in the profession, and the profession basically hires people almost like apprentices, and then no matter which country you're in, you end up doing a lot of exams. They keep changing the exam syllabus and the pattern of exams, but when I did it, there were 10 exams to pass. And so you sort of start studying on weekends and in the evenings on your own. You get the concept, you read the books, you're immersed in it. And I found it very exciting, and yeah, I knew then that I could get through the exams.
But you then started your own business, which is, one is introverted, the other is, one's measuring risk and the other's taking risks.
Yeah, well, the reason that the nine of us founded Chiron back in 2002 was that the consulting industry had started to try and impose limits of liability on its clients.
What does that mean? For the average person, explain it to us.
Well, essentially, we're dealing with large numbers. You know, typical pension funds measured in hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars. So we're calculating these huge numbers, and if there's a mistake, it doesn't have to be a very big mistake before you end up with a huge difference. And indeed, there have been a fair number of lawsuits over the years. And basically, the industry decided that it would like to limit the amount of liability, i.e. the amount that we could be sued for contractually with our clients, so that the clients could sue us for maybe one or two times the consulting fee rather than the actual damage.
So the company you were with was okay with that?
The company was okay with that, but a lot of our clients weren't, and we could see that basically we were going to be losing opportunities, and we didn't think that hiding behind limits of liability was the honorable thing to do, and that there was a better way of risk management than just by saying, hey, you know, don't sue us because we're going to stop you in a contract.
That's kind of a risky business, though. And how did you find the nine or eight other people together to do this?
Well, we would basically work together, and we all had much the same mindset. So it was more of a transition. We actually tried to negotiate our way out, and for an awful lot of 2002, we spent negotiating our way out, being perfectly open with the company that we wanted out of these problems with a limited liability contracts. And eventually it ended up with a rather acrimonious departure. We formed the company, and for the most of 2003, we had some fairly nasty litigation that eventually we settled.
During the nasty litigation, did it still feel like you were doing the honorable thing and that was satisfying to you?
Yeah. Baptism of fire may have been, but it sure was a bonding experience with the other nine founders. It was well worth doing. There were some days when it was difficult. We were obviously started a company. We did the first 6 months at least with no pay.
And then you got sued.
And we were being sued. Yes. We were incurring the bills for attorney's fees and.
But that bonding and the experience, did a leader emerge? Is that how you wound up as the chief, or was there a team that emerged?
It was a team. I mean, basically, the CEO of the company did an awful lot to make the thing happen. But we're a team, and we operate as a team. We have a fairly democratic sort of way of running the company.
You mentioned in the green room that the hardest thing you've ever had to do was confess to having made a mistake. Yet you were willing to confess to having made a mistake. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it goes back a number of years, but in fact, it wasn't even in this country. The sort of the issue that springs to mind, and we had done some calculations for a very large deal. And one of the problems that we encountered when we went to check our work was that we hadn't apportioned the benefits correctly. So we basically had to go in and say, sorry, but the amount of money that this deal is going to involve is not what we told you, but it's actually going to be the figure that was slightly worse. But fortunately, we were under such pressure to get numbers out that the client understood, which was fortunate. But, it's much better to get these things out in the open than to sweep them under the carpet and hope nobody discovers anything.
It sounds like, once again, you did the honorable thing.
It's the only way of doing business.
Would you give us the web address, please, for Chiron?
Yes, it's www.chiron.us.
Would you spell that for us, please?
Yes, certainly. Chiron is spelled C-H-E-I-R-O-N.
Give it to us one more time. Don't want anybody to miss it.
C-H-E-I-R-O-N.
.us. Thank you very much. We've been speaking with Peter Hardcastle. Peter is the principal consulting actuary and CFO for Chiron. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ed Alera, of the law firm Buchanan Ingersoll Rooney, for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders. And Ed and I will be back in just a moment after these important business spotlights.
Joining us today is
Gordon Bernhardt.
Gordon, what is Bernhardt Wealth Management?
Bernhardt Wealth Management is a registered investment advisory firm. We're one of the top independent wealth management firms in the Washington, D.C. area.
What makes your company special?
I'd say three things. One is that we are a personal chief financial officer. We act in that capacity for our clients, so that means we help them address their investment issues. We also focus on the holistic approach, so that means we focus on wealth enhancement, wealth transfer, wealth protection, and charitable planning issues for our clients. Second area is that makes us special is that we are a registered investment advisor. We don't have a broker's license, and that simply means that we have a fiduciary duty to always act in our client's best interest. Most of the industry have broker's licenses, and some of them have advisory licenses. And a broker is held to a suitability standard. We're held to the fiduciary standard.
So what that means to a customer would mean that you work in their interest, not for the interest of the stock that you're trying to sell.
That is correct. And the third area that makes us special is that we have a very academic approach to investing. Everything that we recommend to our clients is strictly based on academic research.
And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I love helping clients. You know, I'm passionate. I get satisfaction out of knowing that we touch people's lives. We can then, you know, our role is basically free up their time so they can focus on what's important to them. For some of our clients, that means their family and grandkids. For some, it's their business. And others, it's their charitable interests. We solidify their relationships in those areas.
Great. How can someone reach you?
We can be reached by phone at 703-356-4380 or on the web at bernhardtwealth.com.
Great. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and we've been speaking with Gordon Bernhardt from Bernhardt Wealth Management, and this has been your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and I'm joined by my co-host, Ed Alera, of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll & Rooney, and we are thrilled to introduce to you our final guest of the day. His name is Tom Loftus. Tom is the CEO of LS Technologies. So, Tom, welcome to the show, and tell us, what is LS Technologies?
LS Technologies is a federal government contractor. We support the telecommunications. We support the Federal Aviation Administration mostly, but they have contract with the Department of Commerce and the Department of Treasury as well.
What's one thing that you guys do that the average guy like me could understand?
We give the pilots the ability to talk to the air traffic controllers. We help the FAA do that so that planes stay in the sky.
And that's pretty simple and important work. How do you do that? What's your role in all of that?
My role in particular?
Or LS Technologies' role.
We supplement the field workforce in the FAA, and there's you know, thousands of facilities that have to be maintained, and there's large facilities where their air traffic controls and their airway facilities, their technicians work. So we supplement their work when there's, you know, not enough people to cover it as typically happens.
And provide them with those experts.
Yes.
Got it.
Yeah.
How big or small is LS Technologies?
We're 180 people now. We've been around for 11 years.
And you're in 47 states, is that
yes,
right?
And yes, and we pay taxes in 47 states.
You're the CEO, president, and co-founder. I forgot to mention those other two titles. Co-founder, why did you co-found a company?
When I first went to work for the FAA, we spent a lot of time in Oklahoma City. So they bring us all the engineers and technicians from around the country. We would always meet and talk, and we thought we could do it better than they could. So one day I decided to do that, made the jump in 2000 and started the company, and then slowly started hiring the best of the guys I knew out in the field.
So did you have a straight line trajectory from when you were a kid that you wanted to build a business and start and go that way?
No, actually, I'm from a military family, three generations of. So my only exposures have always been to the, you know, serving the government, working for the federal government. I had no idea about it, and I had no desire to work in or start a business. It just kind of evolved and happened.
You mentioned that when you were talking about starting a business, you felt, hey, we can do this better. Yet when I asked you in the green room what was your biggest surprise was I had no idea what I was doing. So tell us about that.
Well, it's easy to, if you're an engineer or a technician, it's easy to work on something. And that's because that's all you're doing. But when you start a business, you don't get to just do that. You have to find people and convince people to let you do that and pay you to do that. Then you have to also manage people, and you have to, you know, run things. There's accounting. There's all those types of things that go on that I had no idea ever existed.
How did you build a company of 180 people to give you that believe in you? What's your background that gave them confidence to come to you and work with you?
When I left the government, which was another big surprise, was that I was not able to work on anything I was familiar with or any of the relationships I built, because there's things that you have to do to stay away from that kind of work. So I was really surprised, thinking I could just walk away and, you know, then convince them now as a contractor that I'll do the same thing, and that wasn't the case for about a year. So for a year it was a rude awakening and a struggle, and happily it was right after Y2K, so there was work that they needed to have done, and we had guys to do that. As I said earlier, I started hiring the best technicians at every large facility that I knew, because what I was doing was hiring the best of the FAA, and then the FAA then came to us and said, you know, you're taking my best guys, we still have to have this work done now. And so the company started that way, and we grew because we did it well. We knew what we were doing, and we always did it well, to the point where one customer would say, hey, we heard that you did this for so-and-so, could you do that for us? So we got to be known as the company that pulled off the miracles of getting things done.
You used this phrase, we knew how to do it well. You also used a phrase in the green room, I'm going to do it my way. And that kind of characterized a lot of your life. Let's go back to when you were the oldest of five growing up. Tell us about life back then and the school of hard knocks and doing it your way.
Well, from the very beginning, it was always that way. Because I was the oldest, my father was in the military, and he was gone a lot. So being the oldest, I was the man of the house, and which I didn't like, because I didn't want that responsibility. Because when you're a teenage kid, you want to go have fun and not be responsible for your kids. And there's a huge gap. There's a 13-year gap between me and my sister.
Why? She's the second oldest.
No, she's the... Well, she was the youngest. The young,
okay, so yeah. You're oldest of five and 13-year gap.
Yeah,
we're 4 years
apart.
Got it, okay.
So there was, and you know, 4 years is a long time, or big distance when you're a kid, so I didn't like any of my siblings either. So that made me, I guess, grow into the point where when I was able to get out on my own, I wanted to do things my own way and by myself. I prefer, to me, it was a bigger accomplishment if I, whatever had happened, moving a mountain, picking something up, or doing whatever it was, even if I didn't know what it was, if I did it myself and I accomplished it myself, it was a bigger thing than having people help me do it.
To talk about your opportunity to attend the academy, your opportunity to have a full ride at Stanford, and what you did with those opportunities.
Well, I threw those away because I thought I knew better. I at the time, I wasn't ready to go to school in the first place. It just happened to be that that's my father's goal, was to have me become an officer. He was an enlisted guy, and he had to do it the hard way, and he didn't want me to do it the hard way. So he insisted on that, and I was accepted to the academy. I turned it down because at 18, there was 4 years of school and a five-year obligation, which meant I was going to be 27 before I was free to do what I wanted to do, so that was out of the question. The full-ride scholarship was also another one of those things. I spent about 7 months in school and then just couldn't bring myself to go back, so I walked away from that, and I didn't bounce around. I just realized I had to do something else, and so I joined the military and did the same things. Did all the hard stuff in the military.
You did it the hard way. And you mentioned something that sort of struck a chord with me because of my father. You mentioned popular mechanics, that you could fix anything. And when did that first show up, and how have you been able to capitalize on it?
Well, I've been lucky enough to be able to fix anything. Before, I'd take a watch apart if it didn't work, because I figured, what do you have to lose? I mean, it's broken anyway, and I'd make it work. At 12 years old, I was reading Popular Mechanics, and they had a crystal set, a radio set for us older guys. And I was growing up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I wanted to listen to the San Francisco Giants games, so I built my own radio set at 12 with no knowledge of starting. It just it happened. I mean, it's not like I could just put it together and it worked the first time. I had to figure out after two or three times of what it was. But I'm typically not a guy to look at manuals. But if I need to know something, I'll read them and then I can figure out how to fix something.
Would it be a stretch to say you're an introvert?
I'm a big introvert. I'm not really comfortable talking about myself or being in the popular person or the person, the center of attention. I'd prefer to be in the background. I listen better than I talk.
But how does that help you build your company?
Well, like, if you want to be successful, you have to go beyond what you feel is natural, and you have to sometimes do things you don't like to do. And I did things I didn't like that I wasn't comfortable doing, but you force yourself to do those things because that's how you keep on moving and be successful.
You are an avid motorcyclist. Tell us about that, and what does that have to do with some of these broader themes in your life?
Well, I'm an adventurist. I've never been afraid to jump for anything or to try anything, and I ride about 70,000 miles a year. I travel around the world on a motorcycle, and it's just adventure. I mean, I like to see things. I like to experience things, and I figure this is my one life, then I better use as much of it as I can.
You mentioned that the guys you ride with, and you ride all over the world, so I'm guessing they're different people. Mm-hmm. They don't know a whole lot about your background. You're just one of the guys who knows how to fix everything.
Right.
What does all that mean?
Well, I don't talk about what I do or what they know me. Like you just said, I'm the guy who can fix the bike that breaks or whatever. I don't talk about myself. I don't say that, you know, I've done all these things. But most of these guys, it's all understood. I mean, some of these guys are more accomplished than me, so I'm just one of the guys to them.
Where do you want to take your company? You've got such an interesting background. Where do you want to take it now?
Well, our main focus is telecommunications and IT work. We're expanding. We're moving into the commercial arena. I have to admit that in the beginning I was naive enough to think I would be happy with a small company for a long time, but that hasn't worked out. We've gotten larger, and it's you know, you're forced to do that.
Well, yeah, you mentioned about every 3 years you decide it's time to take on a new challenge.
Well, this actually running the company is the first job I haven't left after 3 years. When I was growing up, we moved a lot, so about every 3 years it was a whole new experience, new friends, new school, new environment. I've lived in Japan, in Guam, in the Philippines, so about every 3 years throughout my entire life, it was time to move on. And as I tell people now, I would have probably left this job if it wasn't one I was responsible for.
Why is this different? Is it because of what you just mentioned, you're responsible for it, or why is this different? In a few words, why is this different?
180 people. I feel obligated to keep, if I leave, and that's what we're big enough now where I've been able to unload some of the responsibilities I used to have as a COO and a CTO. And so as the company's growing, I'm trying to make myself irrelevant so that the company can exist for another 100 years if it wants to without me.
Yeah, but the reason this is different, in your words, is 180 people.
Correct.
Would you give us the web address for LS Technologies, please?
It's lstechllc.com.
Okay, I don't want anybody to miss it. One more time, please.
lstechllc.com.
Thanks very much. We've been speaking with Tom Loftus, CEO, President, and co-founder of LS Technologies. I'd like to thank all of our guests today, including Peter Hardcastle, Principal Consulting Actuary and CFO of Chiron, Andy Harper, who is the CEO, and Amanda Harper, who's the President of Gale Tech, Jack Walton, Executive Director of American Youth Philharmonic Orchestras, and of course, most recently, Tom Loftus, CEO, President, Co-Founder of LS Technologies. I'd like to thank my co-host, Ed Alera, of the law firm Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney, for helping me with the interviews. Thank you very, very much to you, our listeners. If it were not for you, we would not even have a radio show. So thank you for listening. We'd like to also thank the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce for hosting us. Don't forget to visit us on the web at www.executiveleadersradio.com to learn more about our executive leaders just like Tom. This is your host, Mike Mannion, with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, signing off. Once again, thank you for listening, and until next time, bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal
this
news.
This paid commercial
may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility.